Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the 2013 Legal Issues webinar series. Today is the last session in our series for the 2012 and 2013 period. Before we begin our session and our speakers start, I just want to run through a few of the logistics of the webinar platform for those of you who might be new to that platform or to our system. So today's audio is being provided through your computer. You can make sure your speakers are turned on and your headphones are plugged in if that's what you're using. You can control the audio broadcast via the audio and video panel by adjusting the sound by sliding the soundbar left or right. If you have any sound quality problems, first thing we'd ask you to do is check your audio controls by going through the audio wizard, which is accessed by selecting the microphone icon on the audio and video panel. If you are choosing to listen by telephone, there is a non-toll-free number available to listen to today's session, 712-432-3066. With passcode 148937. For those of you using mobile apps, there is access via the mobile program available through Blackboard Collaborate for iPhone and iPad, also available now for a Kindle Fire and an Android device as well. Captioning is available today by using the CC icon at the top of the screen in the audio and video panel. It will open a new dialog box. Once you've opened that, you can change your size. You also are able to save the transcript if that's a choice that you have. We'll be taking questions for our presenters today. We'll actually be having two separate times that we'll be taking questions. We'll be breaking in the middle to take some questions and then take some additional questions at the end. So if you are interested in submitting questions, you can do so at any time by submitting through the chat area text box or by using Control-M on your keypad to access the text area checkbox. That will only be viewed by the presenters. The general audience will not see the questions that are submitted. If you don't have access to the webinar platform and are only on the phone today, you can also send an email with your question to webinars@ada-audio.org. Please note that this session is being recorded. You will be able to access the recording at the ada-audio.org website within 24 hours after the conclusion of today's session. You can customize your view today for better viewing for yourself. It doesn't affect anyone else when you change things, but you can resize the whiteboard where the presentation slides are shown to make it smaller or larger. By choosing the icon, there is a default at the top of the whiteboard where the slides are that says Fit Page. If you open that up, it has a drop-down menu. It gives you other options. Again, this will change only your view, not anyone else's in the session. You could also resize and reposition the chat or participant audio panels as well by detaching them. You can use your mouse to reposition or stretch and shrink as well. Each panel may be detached by using the little icon that looks like a series of lines on a piece of paper in the upper right-hand corner of each panel. You'll see the option to detach. If you have any problems today with your technical issues, you can contact us through either a private message by choosing Great Lakes ADA in the participant list, or you can email us at webinars@adaaudio.org or call us at 877-232-1990, both voice and TTY, and our staff will be happy to assist you. So at this time, I am going to turn over today's session to our presenters, who are Barry Taylor and Rachel Weisberg, both with Equip for Equality, and their bios are available on the website, so you can review them if you're interested. So at this time, Barry, I'm going to turn that microphone over to you.
Thanks, Robin, and hello, everybody. We're so glad you could join us today to talk about what's going on with the courts and how they're interpreting the ADA Amendments Act 5 years after its passage. Hard to believe it's been 5 years. Those of you who are in Illinois and are attorneys, this session is available for continuing legal education credit, 1.5 hours, and all you need to do to get that credit is at the end of the session, shoot me an email confirming that you attended the whole session. And my email address is barryt@equipforequality.org. And then we'll follow up with you with all the paperwork. And we'll shoot the slide up in front of you at the end of the session as well. So today, we're going to be talking about a number of things. And we're going to divide it up in two parts. I'm going to start, and I'm going to give a very short background on the ADA Amendments Act, sort of how we got there. Then talk about how the definition of disability and substantial limits has been broadly defined and interpreted by the courts. We'll then turn to episodic conditions and conditions in remission, then talk about how mitigating measures have been impacted by the 80 Amendments Act and the court decisions. Then focus on major life activities and major bodily functions. And then also talk about the EEOC's list of impairments that can easily be shown to be a disability under the ADA. We'll take a break at that point to see if people have any questions. And after we respond to those questions, I'm going to turn it over to my colleague, Rachel Weisberg, and she's going to talk about how the regarded as prong has been changed by the ADA Amendments Act and the courts interpreting those changes. Then focus on transient or short-term impairments. She's also briefly going to talk about regulatory activity and retroactivity, and then additional resources. And then we'll open up for questions once again to answer any questions you have about the whole session. And that should take us to the end of the 90-minute session. So as all of you know, I'm sure if you're attending this webcast, the ADA was passed in 1990, and when the ADA was passed, it was adopted from a definition of disability that was under the Rehabilitation Act, which covered disability discrimination for entities that received federal funding. And as everybody knows, the definition of disability is a physical or mental impairment, substantial limits of major life activity, as well as those who are discriminated because of a record of an impairment or regarded as having such an impairment. And this issue of the definition of disability under the Rehabilitation Act came up before the Supreme Court in 1987 in the Arline case. And in that court, the court said that the definition of disability was to be interpreted very broadly. Then fast forward after the ADA was passed in 1990 up to 1999, and we had a couple of really troubling decisions from the Supreme Court from a disability perspective. The Sutton Trilogy, which you'll all remember, were three cases in which the issue the court looked at was whether or not mitigating measures like medication or assistive devices should be taken into account when determining whether somebody is substantially limited in a major life activity. And the court said, you are to take into account the mitigating measures when determining whether somebody is substantially limited. And so as a result, many people, when you took into account their substantial limitate, their mitigating measure, were found not to be substantially limited in major life activity. And then a few years later, the Supreme Court further narrowed the definition of disability by saying that it should be strictly interpreted to create a demanding standard. And that really was a stark contrast to the Supreme Court's decision in Arline that I referenced earlier 15 years ago, which talked about interpreting it broadly. And it was also contrary to the general policy of interpreting civil rights broadly to effectuate an important purpose. And so as a result, courts regularly found that plaintiffs could not establish they had an ADA qualifying disability, and many, many claims and cases were dismissed just on the issue of whether people were covered by the ADA. So to address this narrow court interpretation concern, in 2008, Congress did pass the ADA Amendments Act, and it had really two major goals. One was to reinstate the broad scope of protection for people with disabilities that had been diminished through erroneous judicial decisions, and also to provide a clear and comprehensive national mandate for the elimination of discrimination that was originally intended by the ADA. And so we're now at 2013, 5 years since Congress passed the ADA Amendments Act, and the question really posed for today's session is, how are the courts interpreting the definition of disability under the ADA Amendments Act? And the short answer, and we're going to provide a lot more detail, the short answer is the courts are following the ADA Amendments Act directives that Congress set forth, and as a result, more people with disabilities are able to pursue their ADA claims and are not having them dismissed because they don't meet the definition of disability. So we believe it has had a major impact. One of the overarching things that Congress said in the ADA Amendments Act is that the definition of disability should be construed in favor of broad coverage to the maximum extent possible and permitted by the terms of the law. And they explicitly rejected the Toyota decision that I mentioned, which held that the definition of disability should be interpreted strictly to create a demanding standard. And after the ADA Amendments Act was passed, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission issued regulations that reiterated this issue or this requirement that the ADA should be interpreted to promote broad coverage. So the question is, are the courts following what Congress directed? And yes, courts are uniformly acknowledging that the ADA Amendments Act significantly broadened the ADA's definition of disability and are following what Congress directed them to do. And so we've got some examples of affirmative statements that courts are putting in the Act before they go through the complete analysis of definition of disability, looking at this whole issue of broad coverage. So you'll see the Fournier case where they say the overarching purpose of the ADA Amendments Act is to reinstate the broad scope of protection available under the ADA. Similarly, in the Brodsky case, the court said the ADA Amendments Act is undoubtedly intended to ease the burden of plaintiffs bringing claims pursuant to that statute. More examples. In the Semenko case, the court said that the ADAAA broadened the category of individuals entitled to statutory protection from discrimination under the ADA. In the Kravitz case, the court said that the ADA Amendments Act seeks to broaden the scope of disabilities covered by the ADA after that scope had been narrowed by the Supreme Court interpretation. And in the Diaz case, the court said, we construe this definition liberally with an eye towards broad coverage of individuals under the ADA. This is a stark contrast in what Justice O'Connor said in 2002 in Williams, that the ADA should be interpreted strictly. One thing we're seeing that as a result of this broad definition, many courts are now reaching conclusions about disability quickly without extensive analysis, which is what Congress said they should be doing. So the Edwards case is an example of that. In that case, you had a plaintiff who in the litigation basically submitted some sworn statements that she'd been diagnosed with a medical bowel disease that flared up from time to time, requiring her to take several months of medical leave. And that's pretty much all that she said about her disability. And the court said that without making any other statements or describing her limitations in any greater detail, she had provided enough information under the ADA Amendments Act to be sufficient to go forward with her ADA claim. The court also said that by passing the ADA Amendments Act, Congress intended that courts focus less on the question of whether the plaintiff is disabled and able to meet the definition, and more on the actions of the employer and whether they're in compliance with the ADA. So the analysis is less on proving you have a disability and more on is the covered entity, oftentimes the employer, doing what they're supposed to do under the ADA. In addition to focusing on the concept that the definition of disability should be broadly interpreted, Congress also, along with the EEOC, provided guidance on specific aspects of the definition of disability, specifically the provisions of substantial limitation and major life activity. And so we'll first focus on substantial limitation. And courts are acknowledging that the EEOC's regulations that whether an impairment substantial limits a major life activity should not demand extensive analysis, that is being cited favorably in many, many cases. And we've got an example here, the Gibbs case. In that case, you had an employee with carpal tunnel syndrome, and she had undergone many surgeries and had been unable to use her left hand for several weeks. And the court said this is not an inquiry that's meant to be extensive or demanding. And they allowed the case to proceed, finding that she had a disability, concluded that the employee had provided some evidence that the condition affected her ability to perform the major life activity of manual tasks. And I think what's interesting about this, in addition to sort of favorably quoting the EEOC's regulation, is that many cases before the ADA Amendments Act involving people with carpal tunnel syndrome were dismissed because they could not meet the definition of disability. And I think this case is a good indicator of how many people are now being able to pursue their ADA claims and being found to have a disability. Courts are also considering not just sort of the outcomes of what actually happens as far as their performing a major life activity, but also the condition, manner, and duration when determining whether somebody is substantially limited in that major life activity. There are a couple of good examples here on this page. The Howard case is the first one, and in that case, the court talked about they would consider the pain a plaintiff with fibromyalgia experiences while performing activities and determining that the plaintiff presented sufficient evidence that she had a disability. So with her fibromyalgia, she was substantially limited in the major life activities of walking, sleeping, and performing manual tasks when compared with most people in the general population. And this is an important point because one thing that Congress changed is and the EEOC and its regulations, they used to talk about comparing people with the average person. And it's been changed now to say comparing with the general population. The average person seemed to connote that you would have to provide statistical analysis. And Congress said, we don't want people spending a lot of time with statistical analysis in most cases. Usually you're going to be able to do so without having to go into that level of detail and requiring expert witnesses and that kind of thing. So this case reconfirms that position. And the court also said that it's appropriate to consider pain as was set forth in the EEOC regulations. And the Molina case is another case about considering pain and focusing less on the outcomes when determining, in that case, the plaintiff's back injuries could constitute a disability under analogous state law. It was brought under Texas law, but it's really mirrored on the ADA. And the EEOC regulations inform us on this. It talks about don't focus on the outcomes the person can achieve. You really shouldn't be, to show that you have an ADA disability doesn't show that you have to show that you're prevented or significantly or severely restricted from performing major life activities to be covered. It's enough to show that the condition or the manner of performing that major life activity is substantially limited when you compare it to the general population. So the fact that this person was in pain when they were performing job functions was enough, even though they were able to perform these job functions. In that case, just real quickly, the plaintiff had testified that she had learned to work through her pain to continue performing her regular tasks. So the fact that she wasn't precluded from performing those tasks didn't mean that she was denied as having a disability. And I think many similar fact situations before the ADA Amendments Act would have resulted in a different analysis and conclusion by the court. The next issue we want to talk about is, you know, prior to the ADA, many impairments that were episodic or in remission weren't deemed to be covered by the ADA. Examples are cancer, or mental illness, epilepsy, or heart disease. And the reason was Justice O'Connor, and I think it was the Sutton case, had said, you know, the language of the definition of disability is substantially limits. It's the present tense. And that means you must show a substantial limitation at the actual time of the alleged discrimination. Otherwise, the Congress wouldn't have put in the present tense. And Congress said, Justice O'Connor, respectfully, you got it wrong. What we need here is we're going to say instead that an impairment that is episodic or in remission is a disability if it would be substantially limiting in a major life activity when active. You do not have to prove that you are substantially limited at the time of the adverse action. You just have to show that it would be substantially limited when active, taking into account that many people's impairments are episodic and sometimes in remission. And this was reiterated in the EEOC's regulation. And as we move forward with the court interpretation, the vast majority of courts are properly evaluating whether an individual's disability is substantially limited when active, taking the cue from Congress. And we've got some examples of this. The Kinney case at the top of this slide involved an employee who had isolated bouts of depression, and they said he could have an ADA disability under the ADA Amendments Act new paradigm. And this is a case that really went against the previous precedent in the Seventh Circuit where Indiana is located. Before the ADA Amendments Act, there were numerous cases involving people who had isolated bouts of depression, and they were found not to be covered by the ADA, which shows what an impact this law has had on people pursuing their ADA claims. And the court went on to say that even though the depression didn't impact the work performance at the time of the adverse action, there was evidence that when the depression was active earlier, it did. She was suicidal and was hospitalized, and that was enough. And similarly, the Edwards case, which we talked about before, the one with the person with the bowel disease that flared up from time to time, the court said the definition of disability now includes episodic impairments that would substantially limit a major life activity when active. And she showed evidence that when it was active, she was limited in a major life activity, even though that wasn't the case at the exact time of the adverse action. And the Howard case goes along that same sort of similar thought. In this case, you had a plaintiff with fibromyalgia, and the defendant said, well, because she testified that her symptoms wax and wane, basically come and go, she shouldn't be deemed a person with disability. And the court said, the ADA Amendments Act plainly forecloses this line of reasoning. They will no longer accept this episodic condition argument in preventing somebody from being covered by the ADA. And on this slide, we have some examples of episodic conditions that have been found to be covered. Kidney stones case, the Esparza case. In the Molina case, they focused on back impairments. They said intermittent back pain is sufficient. The Pierce-Mato case involved vocal cord edema. The Carbaugh case involved multiple sclerosis. The Hardin case involved hepatitis C. And for those of you who've been looking at the ADA for a long time, you'll note that a lot of these impairments that are listed on this page, prior to the ADA, many of them have been found not to be covered by the ADA because of their inherent episodic nature. And the ADA Amendments Act really changes all of that. However, there is at least one court that we know of, and you may know of others, this is the one that we found, has failed to apply the ADA Amendments Act revised standard. And basically, in our opinion, they just got it wrong. This isn't really a judgment call. This is really an erroneous application of the law. And this was somebody who had what's called sporadic angina spasms, a cardiac condition. And they found those weren't substantially limiting. The spasms were periodic and unpredictable, not ongoing. And the court stated, in our view, erroneously, that the principle that intermittent impairments such as those resulting from plaintiff's sporadic angina spasms are not deemed disabling, that remains good law. So basically they're saying that despite the fact that Congress passed this law saying that episodic impairments can be covered as long as you could show they were substantially limited when active, the court basically ignored that. And as far as we can tell, there wasn't an appeal of that case or any subsequent cases overturning that. So that case has not been, hasn't been overturned, and there hasn't been a Sixth Circuit case addressing this issue. So that's something to watch for. But again, we think this is a very isolated, maybe the only case where basically the court has erroneously applied the law post-ADA Amendments Act with respect to episodic conditions. So the ADA Amendments Act not only impacts episodic conditions, but also those conditions that are considered in remission. And people might remember before the ADA Amendments Act, many cases involving plaintiffs whose cancer was in remission were dismissed. And now what we're seeing is that courts are consistently finding that the ADA Amendments Act does cover people who have cancer in remission. The Hoffman case was one of the first cases and is very clear. In that case, the defendant had argued there was no disability because the employee's cancer was in remission. They had no work restrictions at the time of the adverse action. The defendant said, "We highly doubt Congress intended all cancer survivors in remission with no medical evidence of active disease to be considered disabled under the law for the rest of their lives." And the court disagreed, saying, "Look, the ADA Amendments Act language is clear. These folks are covered. The plaintiff doesn't have to show he was substantially limited in major life activity at the time of the adverse action." And the conclusion was further bolstered in the court's opinion by the EEOC's guidance listing cancer as an example of an impairment that is episodic or in remission. So one of the things the EEOC has put out is a list. It's a non-exhaustive list, but it's a list to help guide the courts and other parties covered by the ADA and working with the ADA about some typical episodic and conditions or impairments that can go in remission. And the list were epilepsy, hypertension, diabetes, asthma, multiple sclerosis, cancer, and a number of psychiatric disabilities, including major depressive disorder, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, and post-traumatic stress disorder. So again, these lists by the EEOC, although not an exhaustive list, are helpful to the court and are being cited favorably by the court in many cases. I alluded to at the beginning of the session that one of the major changes is to respond to the Sutton case that said that mitigating measures had to be taken into consideration when determining whether somebody was substantially limited in a major life activity. And it's right in the rules of construction of the ADA Amendments Act. It says that courts are required to consider whether an individual has a disability without taking into account the effects of mitigating measures, the exception being for ordinary eyeglasses and contact lenses. And this is really a policy of not wanting to force employees to choose between using mitigating measures to address the manifestations of their impairment and being covered by a civil rights law. That's a terrible choice to put people under. So that's just been eliminated, and the Supreme Court decision is no longer valid law on this issue. And the in the actual ADA Amendments Act text, the Congress put in a number of examples of mitigating measures that are listed on the slide. And then the EEOC added some additional mitigating measures. This is, again, non-exhaustive lists, but to give courts guidance when they're trying to struggle, well, what do we do here? Oh, these are mitigating measures we should not take into account. Now, remember that courts can and should take into account the mitigating measures when analyzing whether the plaintiff is qualified, because that's how they're actually performing the job, usually using those mitigating measures. They just can't take into account mitigating measures when determining whether somebody has a disability, but it's totally appropriate to do so when determining whether they're qualified, which is the next stage of the analysis. And the courts, again, as we talked about before, are following Congress's directive, and in this case, applying the fact, are disregarding ameliorative effects of mitigating measures. And the Orney case is a good example of that. This was an employee who was diagnosed with sleep apnea, and after being diagnosed with sleep apnea, she began to treat the condition with a CPAP machine. That's a continuing positive airway pressure machine that keeps the person's airway open and addresses the sleep apnea. And the employee had previously struggled to stay awake and concentrate at work, but once he started to use the CPAP machine, he no longer had these problems. And so after he filed his claim for discrimination, the employer argued, wait a second, they don't have a disability anymore because they've been cured or relieved by the CPAP machine. And the court said, nope, when you apply the ADA Amendments Act, that argument is without merit. You do not take into consideration the mitigating measure, here the CPAP machine, and they allow the employee's claim to go forward. And as I noted before, there is this non-exhaustive list in the text of the ADA and supplemented by the EEOC of examples of mitigating measures. And if you look at that complete list, it does include oxygen therapy equipment, which is what a CPAP machine is. So that list has been very helpful for courts. And, you know, if you, again, we've been looking at ADA cases for a long time, you'll remember that before the ADA Amendments Act, many people who had sleep apnea had their cases dismissed as not being able to show they were substantially limited in a major life activity. So this shows a big change for those folks. And the Hardy case is another example of the court following Congress. This is somebody who had restrictions in his ability to kneel, squat, run and jump, climb stairs, and so forth, that arose from a prior knee injury he had had that was not completely healed and then re-injured on the job. And as he got into the job, he found ways to mitigate the impact of his physical restrictions. He used pain medication as well as cane and crutches. And the employer argued, well, he's not substantially limited with mitigating measures. He can perform all his job functions, so there's no disability here. And the court disagreed. They said, when you disregard the mitigating measures employed by the plaintiff here, he did have substantial limitations and therefore an ADA disability. And really taking, like I said before, taking into account the person with their mitigation is what you do when you're looking at whether they're qualified, not whether they have an ADA disability. It's important to remember that even though Sutton is not good law with respect to taking into account the positive impact of mitigating measures, the one from a disability perspective, the one really good thing about the Sutton decision is it said that you do take into account the negative side effects of a mitigating measure in determining whether somebody is covered by the ADA. And that part of Sutton has not been overruled and is still good. So even though the mitigating measure itself can't be considered, the negative side effects of those mitigating measures can be considered in assessing whether somebody has a disability. And the cases on this slide, the Seam case and the Wells case, are a good example of that. The Seam case, you had somebody who had Graves' disease, and they had negative side effects from the medication. The medication side effects included drowsiness, confusion, and slurred speech. And these symptoms wore off as the day went on, so they had just asked for a shift transfer as a reasonable accommodation, which was denied by the court. And the court ended up saying that when you consider these negative side effects, they found that the person did have an ADA disability. And similarly, in the Wells case, this was somebody who had a gastrointestinal condition, and the negative side effects of the mitigating measure, the medication she used, were blackouts, disorientation, and confusion. And the court took those negative side effects into account when determining whether they were covered by the ADA. So those are part of the analysis. The negative side effects of a mitigating measure can be taken into account, but the use of the mitigating measure, generally the positive effects it does, no longer can be taken into account. So it's important to understand that distinction. It's important, even though the court was clear, or the Congress was clear, that you don't take into account mitigating measures, in certain courts you may need to demonstrate how these conditions substantially limit a major life activity if they were removed. If the plaintiff still has the burden of proof, you know, the court, Congress was clear that there are no per se disabilities. So some courts won't presume a substantial limitation without a mitigating measure unless there is some evidence provided by the plaintiff as to how they would be if they didn't take their mitigating measure. And in the Lloyd case, the court said, you know, otherwise, if you don't require the plaintiff to put on some evidence, it's going to require the court to gaze into a crystal ball to figure out how they would be without, you know, if they went without their mitigating measures. So there is an affirmative duty from this court's perspective to put on evidence on that. I'm not sure all courts would require that, but as a matter of sort of good practice, I think it's important to put that evidence in front of the court if you have it to help them get to where you need them to get if you're litigating an ADA case. And so the court recognized that the ADA Amendments Act required it to evaluate the plaintiff's condition in the unmitigated state, but they still concluded that the plaintiff failed to provide evidence about how his asthma and blood pressure would affect him if it was left untreated. And by not putting that evidence, the court found that he did not have a disability. And similarly, in the O'Donnell case, the plaintiff did not show how the mental health disorders were substantially limiting, either treated or untreated with mitigating measures. There was really nothing in the complaint that identified how the mental illness substantially limited a major life activity. They just stated the diagnosis, and the court said that's not enough. So we talked about substantial limitation, and now let's talk about major life activities. So remember, the original ADA, there was no listing in the text of the ADA itself on examples of major life activities, and as a result, there was significant litigation over what was considered a major life activity. So to correct that problem and, you know, to reduce the confusion and unnecessary litigation on this issue, Congress included within the text of the ADA Amendments Act itself a non-exhaustive list of major life activities. And those are listed on the slide. And then the EEOC and their regulations added three additional major life activities, interacting with others, sitting, and reaching. And again, both the text of the ADA and the EEOC make clear that these lists are non-exhaustive, but again, do give courts more guidance on interpreting what is considered a major life activity. So as a result of the ADA Amendments Act, we no longer are seeing a significant amount of litigation on the definition of major life activities because so much guidance has been given by Congress as well as the EEOC. And the Barmier case is an example of that. They confirmed that social interaction or interacting with others, which is one of those listed by the EEOC and its regulations, was a major life activity under the ADA Amendments Act. And they noted that the court ultimately did dismiss this case because there wasn't shown causation between the disability and the adverse employment action. But the important thing here is that the EEOC's list is being cited favorably by courts. And interacting with others, if you remember some of the pre-ADA Amendments Act cases, some of the courts rejected that, saying that that was not a major life activity, but they really can't do that now that Congress has put what is a major life activity in the law, and then the EEOC has supplemented that with its regulations. So as we said, the prediction here is we're not going to see a lot of litigation on the issue of major life activity because so many are now explicitly in the text of the ADA. The Thomas case is another example where courts are taking a broader view of major life activities. This was somebody who had anemia and it caused her to sleep excessively. She had a hard time waking up. And the defendant made, I think, maybe a decent argument. They said, you know, she's not substantially limited in the major life activity of sleeping because that's about people who don't sleep enough. She's not limiting in sleeping. She sleeps too much. And really her limitation is she can't wake up, not that she has a hard time sleeping. And the court said, you know, we're not going to accept your argument. We can't include as a matter of law that waking up is not a major life activity. And I think what this case shows is that courts are willing to go beyond those nature life activities listed in the text of the ADA and the EEOC's list. Waking up is not listed in either of those lists, but because those are non-exhaustive, courts are willing to go beyond that. You know, before the ADA Amendments Act was passed, there were some impairments that plaintiffs just had a real hard time showing they're substantially limited in those traditional major life activities, and therefore a lot of those cases were dismissed. And those are cases involving impairments like cancer and heart disease and diabetes, where it was just really hard to find sort of a traditional major life activity that was a fit. And so Congress, to address those cases, said we're going to broaden the definition of major life activity to include the concept of major bodily functions. And they, again, right in the text of the ADA Amendments Act, they put some examples of major bodily functions, like the immune system, the neurological system, normal cell growth, the brain system, digestive system, and on. And they also clarified that this is not an exhaustive list. And then the EEOC, as it's done in some of the other parts of the ADA, have added additional examples of major bodily functions. And probably the most important one is they added musculoskeletal. And that's probably most important because of the high incidence of discrimination claims filed by people with back impairments. And by having this listed as a major bodily function, people with back impairments can say not only are they substantially limited in maybe bending or lifting or reaching, but they can also say substantially limited in the major bodily function of the musculoskeletal system. And that will enhance their claim. And as we're seeing, courts are consistently applying this new concept of major bodily functions in determining whether somebody has an ADA disability. And we have a number of examples on these next few slides. So you'll see diabetes, substantial limits to endocrine system, cancer, substantial limits normal cell growth, HIV, substantial limits the immune system. So we no longer have to say that somebody with HIV is substantially limited in the major life activity of reproduction, which was the argument in the Bragdon case, the first ADA case before the Supreme Court. You can just say, if you have HIV, you're substantially limited in the major bodily function of the immune system. That's enough. Heart disease, substantial limits to the circulatory system. Irritable bowel syndrome, substantial limits bowel functions. Graves' disease, substantial limits a number of functions, including immune, circulatory, and endocrine functions. Multiple sclerosis, substantial limits the neurological functions. Brain tumor, substantially limits brain functions and normal cell growth. Spinal stenosis and other similar types of impairments substantially limit the operation of the musculoskeletal system. Removal of the stomach limits the bowel and digestive bodily functions. Post-traumatic stress disorder and other mental illnesses substantially limits brain functioning. And hepatitis C, another one that was hard to prove under the pre-ADA Amendments Act, limits the immune system, digestive, bowel, and bladder functions. So that will be much easier to prove that you have a disability with these major bodily function options. Now, what's important to do is to make clear in your pleadings, if you are litigating these cases, what the major life activity and bodily function is impacted by the particular impairment. And the Fierro case is a case where the plaintiff did not do this. The plaintiff was not represented by an attorney representing himself, and he said he has cancer and it rendered him disabled. He didn't talk about any major life activity or major bodily function. And the court, you know, some courts, I think, especially involving pro se plaintiffs, would maybe assist in the analysis. But basically, they said this particular court dismissed the claim, finding that they had not put forth sufficient pleadings and evidence of how the impairment substantially limited any major life activity. So it's important to make sure you have that in. And then this last thing I just wanted to mention is that the EEOC regulations now include a list of 18 impairments that should easily be found to be substantially limiting a major life activity. And what they're basically saying is while there's no per se disability, not much evidence should be needed to show the substantial limitation. And they have a number of examples here on this slide. I won't read them all, but these are all ones where if your courts are looking at these cases, they should not be requiring much evidence and should be able to find that these kinds of impairments, Congress intended these to easily be found to be disabilities under the ADA. And generally, courts are deferring to the EEOC's list. The Franklin case is a good example where they found that post-traumatic stress disorder is an impairment because it should easily be found to be substantially limiting brain function, given that it's on the EEOC's list. And then cases on this page all did the same. The Angel case, the court said you don't need drawn-out analysis, concluding that cancer is a disability. Same thing in the Horgan case about HIV, and the Sawarza case, I'm probably pronouncing that incorrectly, said the same thing about diabetes, that will, as a factual matter, virtually always be found to impose a substantial limitation on the endocrine function. And that's a real change. So many cases with diabetes were dismissed because people could not show they had a substantial limitation in major life activity. So this list by the EEOC is being used frequently by courts and making it much easier for people with disabilities to move forward. Now, some courts won't conclude that an individual has a disability without actually showing one of the impairments is listed. So this is one where that they actually have one of the impairments listed. So this is one where somebody just basically just put out that they have post-traumatic stress disorder and didn't really provide anything other than the bare assertion that they had this diagnosis. And so when you're before courts like these, you really need to put for more information about the fact that you have this, you're diagnosed with it, and how it substantially limits some major life activity. So one of the questions we have is, what about impairments that aren't on the list? And this may be an issue that has more litigation. There's some examples that aren't on the list, like learning disabilities, arthritis, anxiety, and back injuries. Again, those impairments aren't on the list, but some of the major life activities that involve them, like back injuries and musculoskeletal, are within the ADA Amendments Act. So our prediction is, due to the other provisions requiring broad interpretation of the definition of disability and the listing of these different major life activities and major bodily functions, people with disabilities should be pretty optimistic that those cases won't be dismissed on the definition of disability. But again, since they're not on the list, there may need to be put a little bit more evidence and proof before the court to ensure that you move forward. So that's a good place to break before we turn over to Rachel. We want to see if we have any questions.
Barry, you have a fun question of somebody asking if you could give any examples of major life activity of reproductive.
Yeah, I think that would be somebody who has any kind of impairment affecting their reproductive organs. So if somebody is infertile or has infertility would be an example, yeah.
Okay.
So, now, the thing that always people get confused when you start talking about infertility and reproduction and things like that is people are like, wait a second, that doesn't track. People aren't, you know, doing that kind of thing on the job. You're not reproducing on the job. Why is that relevant in an employment discrimination case? And really the analysis about whether you have a disability is separate, and you do that first just to prove that you have a disability, and that really isn't related to your job activities. That's when you get to the qualified analysis. So when we start talking about some of those more intimate type of major life activities, it sometimes is confusing for people, but that really is different. And it's you only look at the job qualifications and how it interfaces with the job once you get past that analysis of whether somebody has a disability.
Okay. So if someone is asking the question, again, since we're on the fertility discussion, is fertility considered a disability like HIV is as it relates to reproduction? Because I think they're referring back to the original HIV case where reproduction as a major life activity was found by the Supreme Court, when we had the Supreme Court decision related to HIV.
Right. Yeah, I haven't seen, and Rachel can comment if she's seen them, I haven't seen any specific cases yet post ADA Amendments Act on infertility, but the way I read it, and just based on sort of, just looking at how Congress has laid out the different major bodily functions, somebody with infertility would be able to show their substantial limit in the major bodily function of reproduction or the reproductive system, and then they would have to move forward with the discrimination claim, but that would get them past the initial hurdle of showing they have a disability under the ADA.
And we've got for conditions on the list, for example, diabetes, what does the litigant need to prove to be considered disabled? Is it just proof of diagnosis, or is there something more?
You know, usually that should be enough. I mean, I think some courts sometimes may say something more, and it doesn't hurt to put in additional information, like I was diagnosed in this year or, that type of thing. But I think the critical thing is not just to list the diagnosis, but also to be clear about what its substantial limits, what major life activity, and not just like the one we had the example of cancer, somebody just putting down cancer and not showing how it substantially limited them, that really sunk his case. And I think if you say with diabetes, that you were diagnosed with diabetes and how it impacts you. And, you know, I think it's just critical for anybody bringing a diabetes case to plead that they are substantially limited in the major bodily function of the endocrine system. The courts have been clear across the board that that's a real connection. And because endocrine system is right in the text of the ADA as a major bodily function, that should be enough. You can certainly say other things like substantially limited in eating and some of the other things that we saw pre-ADA Amendments Act, but really the endocrine system, since it's so connected to diabetes, I think that's really all you need to show.
And someone's saying that they don't see ADHD on the list. Does that mean that it is not a disability under the ADA?
Absolutely not. Let me make this really clear. Courts, all these lists are non-exhaustive lists, meaning that they're not exclusive. You can have other impairments that are going to be considered disabilities if you show a substantial limitation in a major life activity. A lot of these lists are just to give examples of impairments that should easily be found to be covered. So I think if an impairment is not on the list, what that should tell people is not that they aren't covered by the ADA, but that they might need to put on a little bit more evidence than your typical new ADA Amendments Act case.
Okay, and we have another question that somebody posed. That if someone does not actually take or use a mitigating measure, so for example, they're not using a CPAP machine, can you still discipline them for falling asleep on the job, for being late, et cetera?
Yeah, certainly. The conduct standards, as long as they're applied consistently, can still be used. It's really up to the person with the disability's choice on whether or not to use the mitigating measure. There were some cases that said if people failed to use a mitigating measure, you could hold that against them pre-ADA Amendments Act. I don't think that's good law, but you can't say, I have this mitigating measure that could take it away. I'm choosing not to do it. I'm going to fall asleep, but don't hold that against me, because if I use my mitigating measure, I wouldn't fall asleep. That's just, courts aren't going to support that claim. So employers can certainly have standards in the workplace, like issues around violence or issues about staying awake and attendance and things like that. And if people choose not to use their mitigating measures and can't meet those standards, that's really on them, not on the employer.
Great. Okay, well, thank you. I think that we're ready then to transition to Rachel, and then we'll come back to Q&A after Rachel again to see if we have some additional questions.
Thanks, Robin. Rachel, why don't you start us off with regarded as?
Sounds good. Thanks, Barry, and thanks, Robin. So as Barry mentioned, I will be discussing the remaining categories today, starting with the ADA's new formulation of the regarded as prong. Now, before the Amendments Act, it was very difficult for plaintiffs to demonstrate that they were regarded as having a disability. And the reason for that is that they needed to produce evidence both that they were regarded as or perceived as having an impairment and that they were perceived to have a substantial limitation in a major life activity. Now, it's always a challenge for a plaintiff to get into somebody else's head, and to show this was a very challenging standard for people to meet. So Congress corrected this problem with the ADA Amendments Act, and now to qualify for coverage under the regarded as prong, all an individual needs to show is that they were perceived to have an impairment. So in other words, the plaintiff no longer needs to show that they are perceived to have a substantial limitation in a major life activity. So as you can expect, this is going to be a much easier standard to meet, and so much so that the EEOC has even said that in many cases, there's really no reason for plaintiffs to seek coverage under any prong other than the regarded as prong, as long as there's a couple exceptions to that, which we'll discuss a little later, which is when an individual is bringing a claim for a reasonable accommodation. But if someone's not bringing a claim for reasonable accommodation, there's really no reason to even bring a claim under actual disability or record of disability, because they're most often going to be able to satisfy the regarded as disability prong. Okay, so now that we know that Congress has greatly broadened the regarded as prong, the next question is what's happening in the courts. And so from our review of the case law, it appears pretty consistent with what Barry's talked about before, that the courts are properly applying the ADA Amendments Act's new iteration of the regarded as prong. One good example of this is this Minault case. And in this case, there was a restaurant manager who was diagnosed with a brain tumor and needed surgery. And so the manager told his employer that, you know, he had just had this diagnosis and that he was going to need surgery. And lo and behold, 3 days later, he was fired. So without much discussion or analysis, the court simply concluded that the employer regarded the employee as having a disability. And it explained that it did so because it had knowledge that the employee had a brain tumor that required surgery. And that's really the extent of some of the court's analysis. What's interesting in this case is that P.F. Chang's, which is the employer, argued that if the court actually did find that the employee was regarded as having a disability, then it would suggest that any time an employee ever informs an employer or a manager of a health condition, then it would automatically make it a regarded as claim. And kind of made the slippery slope sort of argument. And the court rejected the employer's argument, both generally and as applied to the specific case. So what the court said first was that the Amendments Act directs the definition of disability to be construed broadly. And then it also said that P.F. Chang's concerns, in any event, certainly don't apply to this case because there was clear knowledge that the employer had observation that the employer had knowledge of the employee's brain tumor and that the brain tumor was going to require surgery. So the court allowed the claim to proceed. Another good example of the way that courts are applying this new regarded as prong can be found in the Darcy case. Here there was an employer who referred to his employee as an alcoholic and then transferred that employee from one position in a narcotics division to a less sensitive position. So the employee brought a regarded as claim, and the defendant responded by arguing that the ADA protections don't apply unless the employee actually has an impairment. Kind of tried to get away from the perceived to have, but said this employee does not actually use alcohol, it's not actually an alcoholic. And with some pretty strong language, the court disagreed and explained that perceptions can be the agents of improper bias and prejudice, and really gets into the policy reasons for even having this type of regarded as prong. And so the court found that a reasonable jury could find that the city regarded an employee as having a disability and let the case proceed. Another just kind of interesting thing to note about this Darcy case is that this is one of the very few cases that applied the ADA Amendments Act retroactively, which is a topic we'll talk about a little bit later. But here, the actions that took place actually occurred in 2004, long before the ADA Amendments Act was passed. But the court still applied the ADA Amendments Act standard to this case. So we also wanted to briefly emphasize that courts are finding that whether an individual is regarded as having an impairment, it's not subject to a functional test. And that's kind of the same idea as, when you look at whether someone's regarded as having a disability, you no longer look at whether the impairment is perceived to substantially limit a major life activity. So the one case we wanted to mention is the Saley case, where the employee had hemochromatosis, which is a disease where too much iron builds up in the body. And the court found that the employee was regarded as having an impairment and made it very clear that it did not matter that the employee had no symptoms of his condition. And the court just said that employees who are bringing claims under the new regarded as prong may recover in the absence of visible symptoms or no symptoms at all. And similarly, in this Johnson case, the defendant argued that the employee was not regarded as having a disability because her sleep apnea did not substantially limit a major life activity. And once again, the court complied with the ADA's directives, applied this broader standard under the Amendments Act, and said that whether or not the employee's impairment was perceived to substantially limit a major life activity was no longer relevant. So one good way to compare how courts are applying the regarded as prong both before the Amendments Act and after is to actually look at a case that has allegations that both predate and postdate the Amendments Act to see how the court applies the regarded as prong in both circumstances, which is why we wanted to talk a little bit about this Wolf case, which comes out of the 11th Circuit. Now, this case was brought by an individual with ADHD, and again, he brought a claim saying that he was regarded as having a disability both before the ADA's Amendments Act and after the ADA Amendments Act. So starting with the pre-Amendments Act allegations, Here, the court found that the plaintiff was not regarded as having a disability. The court followed this pre-ADA Amendments Act precedent and considered whether the employer perceived the employee's ADHD to substantially limit a major life activity. And the employee, you know, he pled that he had ADHD, that was his impairment, and that he was substantially limited in working. So the court looked at this and said, okay, there is some evidence that the employee supervisors believed that the employee had a limited attention span, but there wasn't enough evidence to show that he was substantially limited in a broad class of jobs. And that was that's the standard to show a substantial limitation in working. So the court said that in this pre-ADA Amendments Act world, this was not enough, and the plaintiff's claim couldn't proceed. But just compare that to what happened in the post-ADA Amendments Act, in the post-ADA Amendments Act allegations. Here, remember, it's the same sort of thing. The employee has ADHD, is bringing similar claims, but here, all the court did is it said that the ADA Amendments Act standard, all the plaintiff needed to show was that the employer regarded him as having an impairment. And the court quickly concluded that the plaintiff carried his burden of showing this. And that's pretty much all that the court said. So as you can see, these are two very different types of analysis. We also did want to note that what happened next in this case, because it's something that we are seeing somewhat through the post-ADA Amendments Act cases. Here, although the plaintiff did survive the issue on the issue of disability, his claim still failed for other reasons. And what happened here is that the court found that the employee failed to provide sufficient evidence that he was discriminated against because of his perceived disability. So he was unable to make the causation link. So that brings us to the concept of regarded as and reasonable accommodations. As many of you might recall, before the ADA Amendments Act, there was an open question as to whether individuals who are regarded as having a disability were entitled to the ADA's reasonable accommodation requirement. And the courts were somewhat split on this issue. But the ADA Amendments Act answered this question once and for all, and said that the answer is no. Individuals regarded as having disabilities are not eligible for reasonable accommodations. And so far, the courts that have evaluated this issue are generally complying with these statutory requirements. So just an example of kind of how this works, then, it comes from the Ryan case out of North Carolina. In this case, the plaintiff worked as an operating room nurse and had a degenerative joint disease and arthritis in her knee. And so what she did is she requested various adjustments be made to the physical demands of her job. So she asked for restrictions in standing, stooping, kneeling, and crouching. And her employer denied these requests, and the employee filed a lawsuit alleging that she was regarded as having a disability. Now, this case was decided under the ADA Amendments Act, so it shouldn't be a surprise to anyone that the court found that the employer had no obligation to provide the employee with reasonable accommodations and accordingly dismissed the plaintiff's claim. Again, this court was just complying with the ADA Amendments Act's new requirement that individuals who are regarded as cannot claim a failure to accommodate. And we wanted to note one potential unexpected consequence of this new provision, which is something that I don't think we had, or at least I had not thought of before, which was kind of interesting to see in the case law. But in this case, in this Walker case, the employee worked as a cocktail server at a casino. She was injured on the job, and she was fired, and she brought an ADA lawsuit alleging that she was regarded as having a disability. So in response, the casino argued that the employee was not qualified to perform her job, and which is interesting. Usually when employers argue that the employee is not qualified, the employee responds by saying they are qualified. But here, the employee actually admitted that she was not qualified, absent a reasonable accommodation. In other words, she's saying that had she been given a reasonable accommodation of reassignment, she would have been qualified to do her job. But so what happened is the court looked at this case and said, well, under the ADA Amendments Act, employers are not required to accommodate individuals under the regarded as prong. Here, the employee is bringing a regarded as claim, and she's admitting that she's not qualified without a reasonable accommodation. And so therefore, under the ADA Amendments Act, this plaintiff failed to properly allege her claim, and she's not qualified. So the impact of the regarded as new standards, its application to the qualified analysis, I think is an area that's pretty ripe for future litigation, and we might see more cases along this line to come. And this case is also a really good reminder to litigants that, if possible, they should bring claims under both the regarded as and actual disability or record of disability prong if there's any question whatsoever about the need for reasonable accommodation. So when Congress was debating the ADA Amendments Act, many members of the business community fought to ensure that businesses weren't exposed to liability for impairments that were minor and temporary. So Congress addressed this concern by creating an exemption to the regarded as prong. And under this exemption, individuals cannot bring a claim under the regarded as prong if they have impairments or their perceived impairments are both transitory and minor. Okay, so what does that mean? Well, Congress gave us a little help on that. The ADA Amendments Act defines transitory to mean that the impairment will last or is expected to last 6 months or less. However, the ADA Amendments Act does not define minor. So the courts have provided us with some additional guidance on the types of impairments that might fall within this exception to the regarded as prong. In the Davis case, the plaintiff was injured in a car accident and sustained back and shoulder injuries, and she was granted a 3-month leave of absence to recover. And upon her return, she brought an ADA claim in which she alleged she was regarded as having a disability. So the court considered whether the plaintiff's condition fell within this transitory and minor exception and ultimately concluded that it did not. The court said that, yes, the plaintiff's condition did appear to be transitory because it looked like it only was in effect for about 3 months, which is shorter than that 6 months provided for in the law. But the court found that there was nothing to show that her condition was minor. The court said that the plaintiff had these back and shoulder injuries and that the back and the shoulder injuries came with some pain, and that was enough to show that the injuries were not minor. And again, this isn't an either or. This is transitory and minor. So in any event, the court found that this employee did not fall within the transitory and minor exception and allowed the employee's case to proceed. Courts have had occasion to find certain other conditions to be both transitory and minor. And the two examples we have here are the conditions that courts have found to fall within these exceptions are flu, an H1N1 virus, and non-episodic anemia. So what happened in the Lewis case was that a plaintiff with H1N1 actually conceded that her condition was transitory, but argued that it was not minor. And so what the court did is it evaluated the impact of H1N1 and said, no, her symptoms are things like fever, cough, sore throat, body aches. These are all things that are pretty similar to the flu. And so the court concluded that the plaintiff's impairment was not minor and let the claim under regarded as proceed. And similarly, in this Lapeer case, where again the plaintiff had this non-episodic anemia, the question was whether the plaintiff's impairment was transitory and minor. With respect to the transitory analysis, the plaintiff alleged that he had a blood condition that affected him for only 1 week. And so according to the court, this was transitory. And then the court also looked at whether the blood condition was minor. And the court explained that it was minor because it only impacted the plaintiff's ability to work for a week. And the plaintiff was still able to do some work during that time, so it was a minor condition. And so again, the courts have found that both the flu, H1N1, and this non-episodic anemia do fall within the transitory and minor exception, and therefore these employees were not found to be regarded as having a disability. So that takes us to our final slide on the regarded as prong. And it's been pretty clear in the case law so far that it's the defendant's burden to show that a plaintiff's impairment is both transitory and minor. And a good example of this comes from the Dube versus Texas Health case. And in this case, we see a pretty similar fact pattern. The employee was terminated for using 11 weeks of leave to undergo treatment for a serious medical health condition. And she brought a lawsuit saying that she was regarded as having a disability. And the defendant moved to dismiss, asserting that the employee's condition was only temporarily impaired. So the court said that to establish this defense, the defendant was the one that needed to demonstrate that the impairment was both transitory and minor. And here, the defendant was unable to show that the impairment was transitory because even though the employee only took 11 weeks of leave, there was nothing to suggest that the employee's condition didn't actually last longer than that, even though 11 weeks was all of leave was all the employee took. And then the court also said that the defendant was unable to show that the plaintiff's impairment was minor. There was nothing in the complaint at all to suggest that it was. And so the defendant failed to make its burden and therefore was unable to stop the plaintiff's claim from proceeding. Okay, so now that we've spent some time talking about the concept of transient or short-term impairments as they apply to the regardedness prong, I wanted to revisit the actual disability prong to compare how courts are assessing situations where plaintiffs have short-term disabilities. So before doing so, let's review the regulatory framework on this issue. Under the EEOC regulations, short-term impairments can be substantially limiting. The EEOC has made clear that the exception regarding temporary impairments under the regardedness prong does not apply to the actual disability prong or the record of disability prong. And the EEOC also clarified that the effects of an impairment lasting or expecting to last fewer than 6 months can be substantially limiting within the meaning of the definition of actual disability and record of disability. So this is another area where courts have been somewhat inconsistent, and perhaps this is because this is a somewhat complicated provision. In the Newman case, an employee brought an ADA lawsuit after enduring a workplace-related injury that resulted in a lifting restriction for approximately 4 months. So the court considered whether the plaintiff's case should proceed, given its transitory nature. And the court found that the transitory nature of plaintiff's lifting impairment does not automatically prevent him from being qualified as disabled under the ADA standard. So this case, the Newman case, suggests that some courts will allow short-term claims to proceed as the EEOC had recommended in its regulations. However, this Lewis case, which you may recall is the case we just discussed about the plaintiff with H1N1, in addition to bringing a regardedness claim, the plaintiff in Lewis also brought a claim for actual disability. And what the plaintiff claimed is that due to her H1N1 virus, she cannot perform the major life activities for a period of 1 to 2 weeks. And there, the court found that the plaintiff did not have an ADA qualifying disability because the plaintiff's inability to perform major life functions was for only an extremely short duration, and therefore it was not a substantial limitation. Again, in this case might have been different if it was an impairment perhaps more serious than H1N1, but in any event, in the Lewis case, we see an example of a court who's not willing to say that a short impairment rises to the level of a disability under the actual disability prong. And the final case we're going to talk about regarding temporary impairments continues to show how courts are somewhat inconsistent with their analysis of the short-term impairments under the actual disability prong. In this Green case, this case was brought by a pro se plaintiff, so a plaintiff without an attorney, and brought a Title III claim against an inaccessible hotel. The plaintiff here had a mobility impairment and had undergone 3 surgeries, but when he drafted his complaint, he qualified his allegations and pled that he used a walker and a wheelchair at the time of his visit. So the court interpreted this pleading to imply that the plaintiff's need for a mobility device was temporary. The court then cited a bunch of pre-ADA Amendments Act cases and concluded that the plaintiff was not covered by the ADA Amendments Act, even under the ADA Amendments Act broadened definition of disability, because short-term impairments would still not render a person disabled within the meaning of the statute. So you see another court kind of going in a different way about these short-term impairments. So, you know, the question is, why did the court rule this way? Well, I think there's a few different possibilities. You know, one possibility is that this case is an outlier, and maybe if there was a more robust pleading by a plaintiff, never would have come to this. Or it's possible that it's because this is one of the only cases that we're talking about today that does not involve Title I or the ADA's employment provision. This case was brought under Title III, the public accommodations provision. And the EEOC regulations that give that specific guidance about short-term impairments applies technically only to Title I. So what's interesting in this case is that the court did cite the EEOC regulations, but noted that they weren't binding in the Title III context, but they were still useful to understanding the meaning of the ADA Amendments Act. So, you know, you don't really know, but it's possible that this case would have turned out differently if it was an employment case. That reference to the EEOC regulations is a pretty nice transition to our next topic, which is the ADA Amendments Act's discussion of regulatory authority. In the Supreme Court's Sutton decision, which Barry discussed earlier, the court failed to give deference to the EEOC's interpretation of the definition of disability. And Justice O'Connor, in her decision, explained that the court failed to do so because the ADA did not clearly designate any agency to interpret the definition of disability. So Congress responded with the ADA Amendments Act, and in the Amendments Act, Congress clearly and unmistakably granted authority to the EEOC, the Department of Justice, and the Department of Transportation to issue regulations interpreting the definition of disability. And as hopefully you know now, since we've talked about them throughout this webinar, but the EEOC has issued regulations. The Department of Justice and the Department of Transportation have not yet done so, but we believe that the Department of Justice is expected to start its rulemaking process in the near future by issuing a notice of proposed rulemaking. And so far in the courts, there's been no real dispute about whether courts should afford deference to these new agency regulations. And in fact, the courts are relying on federal agency regulations, and they're even citing the specific provision to make sure that they're being very clear that they're allowed to be making these sorts of deferential decisions. So a few examples of how that's being done. In this Kravitz case, what happened is the court evaluated whether the employee's disability substantially limited a major life activity, and in doing so, it cited the EEOC's regulations regarding the term substantially limits, and then just in case there was any doubt that the EEOC's regulations should be afforded deference, it also noted the statutory rule of construction regarding the regulatory authority. And in this Angel case, the court proceeded pretty similarly. The court cited the EEOC's regulations and then added a footnote regarding the statutory grant of authority to do so. So given the clarity of the statutory text on this issue and the cases that we've seen so far, we don't expect this to be a contentious area of litigation down the line. Our next topic is the retroactivity of the ADA Amendments Act. Immediately after the Amendments Act was passed, one of the hottest topics in the courts was whether the law should be applied retroactively. And with a few exceptions, including one of the ones I talked about earlier, courts held that the ADA Amendments Act should not be applied retroactively. And they found this because they followed the general rule that if a statute does not clearly state that it should be applied retroactively, then it's not. And the rationale is that it's unfair to hold the defendant liable for a standard that's been articulated after it engaged in the allegedly unlawful conduct. And the EEOC ultimately chimed in on this issue and stated, stated that the ADA Amendments Act should not be and should not be applied retroactively. However, we think it's interesting to note that at least one court did decide to apply Amendments Act retroactively because the plaintiff was seeking prospective injunctive relief. In this Jenkins case, the plaintiff filed a lawsuit asking for the court to order the National Board of Medical Examiners to do something in the future, to actually engage in some prospective relief, and asked them to grant accommodations on a future test. And so because the plaintiff was asking for the court to do something in the future, the court said, okay, in this case, we will allow the ADA Amendments Act to be applied retroactively because it's not really retroactive. We're actually applying it to conduct that's going to occur in the future after the ADA Amendments Act's effective date. And although some courts have declined to apply the ADA Amendments Act retroactively, courts have still noted the law in many of its decisions and said that the law has bolstered their holding or has supported the analysis that they gave. So one example of this is the Rohr case, where the court found that although the court concluded that the plaintiff's diabetes constituted a disability under the ADA, but the court noted that although the Amendments Act did not apply, it still bolstered their conclusion. So hopefully after listening to this webinar, you're all so intrigued by the judicial interpretations of the ADA Amendments Act to date, and you want to learn more. Well, you're in luck because there's these three great articles that all provide further analysis on how courts have interpreted the ADA Amendments Act, so we'd encourage you to check those out. And we also wanted to provide you with the contact information for a number of ADA resources, which are on slide 67, including the ADA National Network, the EEOC Job Accommodation Network, Department of Justice, and Equip for Equality. And with that, I just wanted to conclude before we get into questions, conclude some of our presentation today by summarizing our observations, and that is that courts are generally complying with Congress's language and broadly interpreting the definition of disability. And yes, as we've discussed, there are a handful of cases where courts are not correctly applying the Amendments Act. However, from what we can tell, these cases do appear to be the exception and not the rule. And then instead, it appears that the Amendments Act has succeeded in broadening protections for people with disabilities. And from these cases to date, it looks that the ADA Amendments Act has effectively focused the judicial analysis away from whether an individual has a disability and toward whether discrimination occurred. I just wanted to remind everyone before turning this back over to Robin and opening the floor for questions that I wanted to remind Illinois-based attorneys that the session is eligible for 1.5 hours of continuing legal education credit. And for those who are interested, should contact Barry at barryt@equipforequality.org. So with that, thanks so much for having us, and I'll turn this back over to Robin.
Robin, are you there for questions?
And I'm not sure that Robin's there, so maybe we will turn it back over to ourselves.
I'm not seeing any questions, but
see one question, which is...
Sorry, go ahead.
Sure, the question that I'm seeing is, the question asks, having a head injury, which is a hidden disability, people have no understanding about it, therefore require I defend myself. Any suggestions? And, you know, the ADA Amendments Act and the ADA itself actually doesn't distinguish at all between hidden disabilities and visible disabilities and invisible disabilities. It really all goes back to that same definition, which is whether you have an impairment that substantially limits a major life activity. And so that's all that you really need to get some coverage. For folks that are looking for help with advocacy, you know, there are a number of agencies out there, and that resource slide that was on slide 67 might be a good place to start to get some ideas if you aren't able to defend yourself and need some additional assistance.
And I would just add, I think one of the actual specific issues that arise for people who have quote-unquote invisible disabilities is that you may need an accommodation and your employer may not know that you have a disability. And so if it comes to a point where you're not able to perform your essential functions without some sort of accommodation, you need to make a decision as to whether you want to reveal that disability and ask for that accommodation. The ADA does have confidentiality provisions which are supposed to protect confidential information, especially those related to things like getting an accommodation. But when you're talking about getting protections and employers understanding, when something's not readily apparent, the burden does fall on the person with disability to provide that information to the extent they need some assistance in the workplace.
Okay, thank you, Barry. Robin gets her microphone just said I was looking through it, and I have a couple questions that did come in. And one is, previous cases that were denied, can they be reawakened based on recent revisions?
So it sounds like the question is, if a person has lost their case, it's been dismissed, can they refile? And typically, those dismissals are what's called with prejudice, meaning that the court has made a final decision and the case is over. And what you would need only able to do to sort of reawaken is if you can show that there's been adverse action post the ADA Amendments Act, and then unless the, some other part of the case has been, you know, survives, you would have to go through the process of filing with the EEOC, exhausting your administrative remedies, and then filing again. But just the fact that a person has been found not to have a disability, it doesn't preclude them from arguing in a future case, even if it's against the same employer, that they have a disability and that now with the ADA Amendments Act, the court should interpret it differently. So you're not sort of exempt from making that argument again, but you can't necessarily resurrect for any adverse action that was taken prior to the ADA Amendments Act application because, as Rachel pointed out, it is not being applied retroactively.
This is Claudia again. I have another question for you coming through the chat room. If a condition qualifies under the ADA but not FMLA, can disciplinary action be taken if employee misses work for the ADA condition?
If an employee qualifies under the ADA but not FMLA, to be able to miss work, the employee should disclose their disability to their employer and request a reasonable accommodation of leave or a modified work schedule, and that would be the way to make sure that disciplinary actions are not given for needing to take some leave. And the courts have found that unpaid leave is a reasonable accommodation under the ADA, although they haven't gone so far to say that indefinite leave is a reasonable accommodation. But as long as there's an end date in sight, depending on the size of the employer and the type of job the individual has, leave frequently is a reasonable accommodation.
Okay.
I agree with that.
Our next question.
I'm sorry, Claudia. I can see the next question and that it's talking about the situation of an individual choosing not to use a mitigating measure and waiting for wanting the employer to provide a reasonable accommodation in place of, such as a person with sleep apnea does nothing to mitigate but wants time off to rest as a reasonable accommodation. I think, you know, as I said before, you're not required to use a mitigating measure and you are entitled to a reasonable accommodation, and there may be reasons you aren't using a mitigating measure. So for instance, there's a case that talks about somebody who had a vocal problem, and if they took steroids, it would, which would be considered a mitigating measure, it would address the manifestations of that vocal problem. That person chose not to do the steroids. It didn't involve other accommodations, but I think in that case, an employer couldn't say, well, that's the mitigating measure you need to use. We're not going to give you any other accommodations. The employer still has a duty upon request to provide reasonable accommodations, even in a situation where somebody chooses not to take a mitigating measure. It really is the person's, with the impairment's choice not to take the mitigating measure, and the employer's duty to provide a reasonable accommodation doesn't sort of go away just because there is an alternative measure. Now, of course, there has to be an interactive process, and maybe the accommodation the person requests is would cause an undue hardship or is not the accommodation the employer thinks is effective, so there's still that interactive process. But just because there's an alternative mitigating measure the person chooses not to take doesn't preclude them from seeking a reasonable accommodation directly through the employer.
All right, thank you. Let me move on to the next question here, and you should be able to see it. It's under the actual or history of impairment prongs. Current alcohol use is a physical impairment and may be a disability if it substantially limits one or more major life activities. But under the new interpretation of regarded as prong. Oops. Sorry, I lost my spacing here. Current alcohol use may be a disability even without proving that such a substantially limits a major life activity. Plaintiffs need only to show that there was knowledge that he was an alcohol user and therefore has a disability under the ADA. Is that a good interpretation?
Yeah, I had a hard time hearing that. Go ahead, Rachel.
I was going to say I had a hard time understanding it, too.
Okay.
Under the regarded as prong, you only need to show that someone was regarded as having an impairment. The ADA's coverage of people who use drugs and alcohol is a little bit complicated, so I don't know that I want to completely go and give an answer on that. I'd be happy to talk to the person further if they have more questions. Barry, do you know how the regarded as having regarded as being an alcoholic would play out?
Yeah, I don't know that we've, at least I haven't seen how that's played out post 80 Amendments Act.
One of the cases that we did talk about today, the person was regarded as being an alcoholic, and that was enough to get them regarded as coverage. And there was no discussion about whether the alcoholism substantially limited a major life activity. What was interesting in that case is that the individual actually was not an alcoholic, and so it was purely based on perception and not based on reality.
Okay, and I asked the participant to submit another comment if they need additional clarification on that one.
Okay.
Let's move on to the next question. Can a person who filed for disability, who submitted documentation for severe depression, PTSD, and bipolar while on FMLA and was denied, do they have a case? They ran out of leave and they have no income due to the disability.
Well, I'm not sure. When they say file for disability, I don't know if that means, if they're looking for Social Security disability or if they're talking about something else. It's kind of unclear with that question exactly, what they're talking about. But there is case law that talks about that if you file for disability under Social Security, saying that you're unable to work, that doesn't necessarily preclude you from also bringing an ADA claim saying that you were discriminated against on the basis of your disability. You just have to explain how you could be unable to work for Social Security purposes, but still be able to show that you are qualified to do the job for ADA purposes.
I think we'll probably do one more question because we're almost at the bottom of the hour, but this question is, does morbid obesity qualify as a disability? Can the individual take leave to cure without losing their job?
Well, this is an interesting issue because it's one that the courts have really been all over the place. But recently, and Rachel can correct me if I'm not remembering this correctly, but I think it was the American Medical Association that talked about obesity as now qualifying as a disease. And so one of the questions came up, does this make it easier to be covered under the ADA? And I saw some analysis by Kai Feldblum, and I think what it really does, I think, is it makes clear that that obesity or morbid obesity is clearly an impairment. But still, remember under the ADA, you still have to show a substantial limitation in a major life activity. Just because something is considered a quote-unquote disease, just like other types of impairments like diabetes and heart disease and those kinds of things, there are no per se disabilities under the ADA, even though it's now easier to prove you have a disability. So somebody with morbid obesity, I think, would be on really solid ground that they have an impairment in light of this recent development, but they would still need to put forth that they are substantially limited in some sort of major life activity arising from that morbid obesity. In many cases, what you'll see is people have maybe substantially limited in the major life activity of walking or some sort of mobility issues because of the morbid obesity. So those would still need to be put forth. And I think the recent development, and again, I believe it's the American Medical Association, really helps the person be on solid ground for the impairment component, but does not necessarily, move them forward with a disability. They still have a substantial limitation in a major life activity that they have to put forth.
Okay. I'm going to sneak in one more question. Would an employee's return from WC or other leaves meet the regarded as prong? Would it trigger the ADA?
Yeah, so WC, I think that what the question asks is, would an employee's return from maybe getting workers' compensation or leave meet the regarded as prong? And under the broadened standard, I think that it would trigger the ADA such that it would meet the regarded as prong. Because remember, all you need to show is that the employee believes or perceives you to have an impairment. And as long as you took the leave or you needed workers' comp because of an impairment, that's going to get you there. Then the next question is, whether the employee is qualified, whether there was discrimination that occurred. But I do think it gets you to the regarded as prong.
Okay, do you want to give any final comments, Barry, before we wrap up today?
Sure. I think Rachel gave a great conclusion. I think, you know, one thing we were going to talk about if we had more time is just that what this means is that a lot of the litigation is going to shift away from definition of disability and some of the other issues. And then I think one of the major issues we're going to see, and this is in one of the articles that Rachel referenced, is that whether somebody's qualified to do the job is where we're going to see a lot more of the litigation. And it may end up that a lot of folks with disabilities can prove they have a disability but still not be able to show they're qualified, but at least they're not going to be struggling with that definition of disability nearly as much as we saw before. And I think other issues, in addition to qualified, like undue hardship and reasonable accommodation, direct threat, which has had some litigation but maybe not as much because so many people never got to that point because their cases were being dismissed based on they couldn't meet the definition of disability. I think we're going to see more litigation on those issues, as well as maybe some litigation on issues of things that aren't explicitly in the ADA, like certain major life activities or certain mitigating measures, as we discussed before.
All right. Thank you, Barry and Rachel, for another great session. We did receive a lot of questions, and unfortunately, we did not get to all of them. But you can call your local ADA center at 1-800-949-4232 and address the questions with your regional ADA center, and they'll help you with that. You can also go to adata.org, and you can find your local regional ADA center on that website. Following today's session, you'll receive an email with an evaluation form. I just want to remind everyone that today's session is recorded, and we will archive that within 24 hours from this session at our website. And that's ada-audio.org. This also concludes the webinar series for the 2012-2013 series. We're working on posting the new series on our website, so keep an eye out for that. Again, that website is ada-audio.org. And with that, I want to thank the presenters. Thank everyone. Have a good afternoon, and this concludes today's session.
Thanks, everybody.